Thank you very much, Steve, for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. You know, going into 2020 election, the Kuomintang was in such a good place because they had just had a big win in 2018. But now the newest poll shows Chai Ing-wen is at 50% approval rate and Han Kuo-yu was at 17%. What happened?
Well, a great deal has happened. Some of it is very, very important, and a lot of it was outside of Taiwan. I think some of the most important influences on changing attitudes in Taiwan came from the outside. It started with the New Year's address by Xi Jinping that was perceived as being a little too harsh, bellicose, and it allowed President Tsai to respond in a way that made her look like a tough defender of Taiwan, a democracy and its sovereignty, and that began a little bit of the rejuvenation of her personal political standing. She went through a challenging primary. It was very, very competitive, and through part of the process, it looked like she might actually be among the very rare presidents to lose a nomination battle in a primary for re-election. Mm-hmm. And then the standards moved a little bit, the vote was delayed a little bit, and she came out on top. The net result of that process was a president who became a much better politician and a stronger candidate in the general election. So while it probably wasn't a pleasant experience for her, it seemed to visibly improve her political standing and her political style coming through that. Coming out of that process, then there was the front end of the Hong Kong demonstrations. And for many, many years, people in Taiwan, China, the world talked about one country, two systems, and the example in Hong Kong being relevant to a longer term arrangement with Taiwan. In fact, in 1997, when sovereignty was changing over, there was a lot of talk about that this would prove to the Taiwan people that, that you can have peaceful coexistence between a free society and the Communist Party of China. And so the demonstrations, and I think initially people were surprised, wondered what would happen, but they went on so long. And some of the images were so compelling of demonstrators that were being injured. There's a lot of talk about the youth, and that was very persuasive and compelling to Taiwan's youth. But there were older families that were going out for the demonstrations. There were retired people that were going out for demonstrations. There were bankers. There were lawyers. It was a wide swath of Hong Kong society. I think that generated a bit of an awakening inside Taiwan of how far the Communist Party was willing to go to interfere in Hong Kong. And that many of those same means of interference would be coming their way in this upcoming election in January and in the long term. So it just profoundly changed the way things were seen. The Nationalist Party for the last decade and a half or so has been known as the party that was proposing a peace agreement between the KMT, the Nationalist Party, and the CCP, the Communist Party, as some way of bringing cross-strait stability and peace. Well, if the CCP is willing to violate an international treaty between the UK and the CCP registered with the United Nations, and if they're willing to violate their own basic law with regard to promises made to the Hong Kong people, what value can there possibly be in a party-to-party agreement on peace between Taiwan and the mainland? And so there's a very significant change of the perceptions of the relative strength of President Tsai in the DPP position, and the relative strength turning, I think, somewhat to weakness of the Nationalist Party position with regard to dealing with mainland China or Beijing. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of these externals had a big, big influence. U.S.-Taiwan relations have been on an upward trend since 2016. That's coincident with President Tsai being elected and coincident with President Trump being elected. And I think the long-term trend of those improved ties also have been seen as somewhat reassuring to the Taiwan people. So all of those things, I think, came together to really change the prospects for President Tsai's re-election and the DPP party's health in a way that I don't think I've ever seen in politics. It's been rapid. Mm-hmm. And really now in the January election, it's almost not a question of whether President Tsai will win re-election. It's a question of whether her party will maintain its majority in the legislative yuan.
That's right.
And that, just a few months ago, was taken as a given that the answer would be no.
Right.
Now it's competitive, so we shall see. But those are the things that changed.
Right. What about the spy case?
Spy cases have played a role, and there's actually been recent legislation that has been introduced and changed in Taiwan. So the legislative yuan has focused less on cross-strait trade and investment, but it has focused on security of Taiwan against CCP influence operations. Among those, espionage. So there's just been a bill passed that will increase the sentencing recommendation for the length of sentence for those convicted of espionage. Mm-hmm. And there's been talk of increasing significantly the penalties on retired military officers in Taiwan who then go to China and get caught up in unsavory things. And so there's been, I think, a hardening of enforcement on the Taiwan side in response to some of these concerns.
Mm-hmm. So do you think this 2020 election of Taiwan would actually be a referendum on the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, I think when we look at elections generally, we always say all politics is local and there'll be Taiwan factors that are driving this, but I honestly think it is a very, very strong referendum on this fundamental question that Hong Kong exposed. Can the CCP peacefully coexist with any free society? And I think so far the answer with Hong Kong is no. And if the answer is no with Hong Kong, it's even more no with Taiwan, and perhaps even with the United States and other free allies of ours. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that what's on the ballot in Taiwan is very much a referendum on Winnie the Pooh and can the image of Xi Jinping and the questions about free speech or control over the Uyghurs or control over business, control over Hong Kong, and I think the people of Taiwan are going to vote overwhelmingly to reject that effort to control them.
Mm-hmm. I think Taiwan has never been really being able to have like a standalone relationship with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's always caught in the relationship between China and the U.S. So against the backdrop of this grand conflict between the U.S. and China, the trade war and everything, how has that brought to Taiwan? And what's your suggestion to the Taiwanese government?
Well, it certainly has been a challenge for Taiwan, but also for the United States and our allies generally. Thankfully, though, it's mostly been a challenge for the Communist Party of China. China's economy has not been doing as well, and most of the world is now awakening to the idea that we shouldn't be treating China under the Communist Party as some kind of an infant. It's a grown-up force in the world, and it needs to abide by the same rules and norms as everyone else. And so this press that, frankly, President Trump started to say that China needs to behave like a more normal nation and we needed to be treated fairly in our dealings, that has spread to Europe, it's spread across Asia, and Taiwan is a part of that too. So there's pressure in Taiwan to make sure that their investments and their enterprises and their trade relationships are treated more fairly, and that's not so easy. I think we're on the front end of a conversation with Taiwan, but also with many, many others, to not think of this as a binary choice. Really, there's one force, the CCP, that's trying to impose an unfair and unjust approach on all of us. And it's not really the United States versus China. It's China versus everyone else that wants a more normal, free pattern of trade and investment and dealings between nations. And so Taiwan, like everyone else, needs to begin diversifying its supply chain. And when it's doing that, that's not just with the United States. That's with Southeast Asia, it's with South Asia, it's with other parts of Asia, it's with the U.S., it's with Canada, Mexico, parts of Europe. It's really all of these free and developed economies that are safer areas, more receptive to a democratic Taiwan, and a prosperous and tech-leading Taiwan. Mm-hmm. In fact, what the Trump administration is doing with the USMCA and the new NAFTA and also with the bilateral trade relationship with Japan, is basically securing almost all of the gains of what would have been TPP without it being TPP. Mm-hmm. And so the opportunity for Taiwan is to have a conversation with its people about how to onshore more of this opportunity, mm-hmm. how to diversify its exposure to things inside communist China, and maybe follow this wave of expanding its economic relations mm-hmm. with Japan, with the USMCA countries, Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Mm-hmm. And really, I hope once through this election cycle, the leadership in Taiwan can look at even more bold ways to propose reallocation of those resources. President Tsai had her southbound policy. I hope that there's a rejuvenation of their economic relations with Canada, Mexico, and the United States as a very, very high priority. I think Japan is looking in those ways too.
That's right, but I don't think it's a clear cut. 40% of Taiwan's export is to China, and there's always this military scenario where China might invade Taiwan. Plus, historically, there's a hurt feeling between U.S. and Taiwan because Nixon chose China over Taiwan. So when you put all these things together, how should Taiwan position itself?
Well, it is a challenge of perceptions versus realities. Mm-hmm. And I think on the perception side, I agree that of your summary of what some of those perceptions are and what the concerns related to those perceptions might be. On the reality side of it, though, Taiwan is a country of 23 million people. It's a substantial economy. It certainly warrants attention on its own merits with regard to U.S. strategy, especially in Asia, but really globally. Taiwan's trade and investment is very, very relevant to key states in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so there's no question on its own merits it should get some degree of support and respect and interchange that wouldn't be open to negotiating away. At the same time, Taiwan, relative to the magnitude of what China is a smaller country. And so when you are a smaller country and a smaller power, in some ways, when you are a part of the bargaining process, in some ways, that's when you stand to benefit the most. If you are not a part of the bargaining process, you sometimes risk being marginalized or ignored. And so what happened when Nixon did what he did? Well, then the Congress, in overwhelming numbers, passed the Taiwan Relations Act, and there was a response to try to highlight and preserve relations with Taiwan. It's been an imperfect balance ever since, and I'm certainly on a voice on the side that says we should recognize Taiwan for what it is, and if China wants to unify with Taiwan, it is free to try. But right now, they have no sovereignty over Taiwan, and the United States should recognize that reality. The world should recognize that reality. And if they find a way to negotiate a union, well, then we'll deal with those facts as they come forward. But we will oppose military imposition of that union, and will respect the dignity, the need for development and prosperity, and other attributes of the free and democratic people of Taiwan. In fact, Taiwan is the only democratic government on this planet the United States does not recognize and have official diplomatic relations with. And so all of those things, I'd be an advocate for fixing. And I think when you get to ordinary Americans, they're on that side in overwhelming numbers if they begin to think about Taiwan. So the dilemma for Taiwan is the only time they get thought about by a critical mass of Americans is when they're potentially at risk. Otherwise, the American people don't know that Taiwan exists. Taiwan and Thailand become the same thing. They don't know what the Republic of China is. Some of the people know because they go on trips. They have important trade relations. But the wide base of Americans don't know, unless we have something like this January election, where the CCP has President Tsai and Taiwan in the crosshairs. Mm-hmm. And when there's a trade war going on, and people start to wonder, well, in the course of this trade war, will there be compromise over things with Taiwan? Well, what's Taiwan? And then the public begins to get engaged. Mm-hmm. And so the message that I would give to reassure the people of Taiwan is that is exactly at these times when they feel like they're at risk, the American people become more aware of who they are, and the American people overwhelmingly stand with them. It's the elites in the think tanks, in the media, and in the permanent government that don't stand with the people of Taiwan, that have been for the geostrategic compromises of the past. So, in an odd way, when Taiwan's going through its elections and we have turbulence in the U.S.-China relations, it's a good time to secure American people's support for the people of Taiwan. And so that's what people like me and that are like-minded in partisan politics. I'm a partisan Republican. I advocate for these things in my party. But there are partisan Democrats that are pro-Taiwan also, that try to take times like this to get aspiring presidential candidates to readjust and to take a stronger position. And the Hong Kong demonstrations have compelled people running for office to come out and stand on the side of those demonstrators. Well, if there's a case to stand on the side of those seeking freedom in Hong Kong, it should be a natural follow-on question when January comes to say, well, where do you stand on the freedom of the people of Taiwan? Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a good set of circumstances. I, of course, understand the anxiety when you're on an island 100 miles off from the China shore. I also understand that these things can't change in an instant. So what you were talking about with 40% of the trade and investment having ties to China, that's a reality. But I think we're at the front end of, if not decoupling, at least diversification, that's going to show progress year upon year of moving more of that exposure out to Asian allies and other places, the USMCA, North American allies, and otherwise. And I think that is a good trend. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, thankfully, Xi Jinping started by being, I think, an overly aggressive leader.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I feel like you are advocating how to take the best advantage of being a bargaining chip.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, it's kind of a, rhetorically, it's kind of a hard, but it's honest and practical.
And you don't get anywhere unless you are in the arena.
Right.
And when you're in the arena, there will be risks and there will be anxieties. But I think right now the moment is good for Taiwan.
That's right. And an example of that would be, you know, Taiwan produces a big portion of their chips that's used around the world. So if China invades Taiwan, and that supply chain got disrupted, wouldn't that be a big impact to the whole world because everyone needs chips for our smartphones and everything else?
It would indeed have a global impact. Okay. I don't have a good feel for what the magnitude would be, other than I think it would be big. I mean, I can't tell you whether it's 70% exposure or 25% exposure, but just think what the world would be like if there was a dramatic drop in the supply necessary for the manufacturing of smartphones. We have an entire population that is completely addicted to using this technology. They wouldn't be able to function for business or everyday life. And so I don't want to make light of the situation, but that is in fact one of the wise ways that the leadership in Taiwan and supporters of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship in the United States can help the average public understand this is why we need to stand by the freedom and democracy of Taiwan. Mm-hmm. It is consistent with our values, but it's also consistent with our fundamental economic interests mm-hmm. and our way of life, not just of values, but our manufacturing supply chain. Mm-hmm. It also is a good argument for why the United States and other allies should help the industries in Taiwan wean away from dependence upon mainland components in what they're doing. They've done that for reasons of scale in manufacturing and price. And so it's not going to be an immediate or easy change. But there are major high-tech manufacturers in Taiwan that need to minimize their supply chain exposure much more than has been the case in the past. But we should work with them to do that for the very reason you point out. We're very dependent on what they produce, and we want Taiwan's manufacturing in this area to succeed.
Mm-hmm. So would you say the strategic importance of Taiwan to the U.S. has increased?
I believe so. Economically, technologically, it has increased. But it's also increased on this threshold question of, can China under CCP leadership coexist with any free society? Mm-hmm. And as these rings move outward, with the answer being no, I think that the options for the United States become expensive and risky and difficult. And so it's all the more important for these frontline democracies in Asia mm-hmm. to remain vibrant, strong, and to increase deterrence mm-hmm. before it's too late.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. policy toward Taiwan has changed after Trump took office. Mm-hmm. And I think for the Taiwanese people, they always worry about the consistency of the U.S. policy toward Taiwan. So in your opinion, even beyond Trump, the Trump administration, would the U.S. policy toward Taiwan experience a big change again?
Well, I spent a lot of my life coming and going to Taiwan, and I think very, very highly of the Taiwanese people, but I'm a very small minority in the United States. Most Americans, whether in the public or in government, they think of Taiwan as a function of how they think about China. Not necessarily that Taiwan is a part of China, but their thinking about Taiwan is a part of their thinking about China.
That's right.
And so when they have very negative views of China, or they think that big changes are necessary in the U.S.-China relationship, mm-hmm. that will affect how they think about Taiwan. I would love it if people in America could consistently just look at Taiwan for what it is, mm-hmm. see value in that relationship. That would be ideal. Mm-hmm. But we don't get to live in that ideal, whether we're supporters of the U.S. relationship from Taiwan or supporters of the Taiwan relationship from the United States. What the reality is that I see both major parties in the United States in a time of significant transition. The Republican Party is much further through the transition. The Democratic Party is in the middle of the transition. Part of that was seen in 2016 at the national conventions, when there were all of the anti-TPP signs that were up in the Republican and the Democrat national conventions. That meant that the base of the party, in significant numbers, was changing its view about trade. There had been a free trade consensus, more on the Republican side, but really in a bipartisan basis, mm-hmm. for several two-term presidents. Mm-hmm. And that was being challenged and upset in 2016. So Bernie Sanders supporters were decidedly against TPP, mm-hmm. and the Democratic convention was overwhelmingly against TPP. Mm-hmm. And the Republican convention, Trump was a new wave Republican that was reaching out to labor, but was very, very critical of these trade agreements. Mm-hmm. And so that was the beginning of a rethinking about trade that I don't think is going to end when the Trump presidency goes into the sunset, and whomever the next president is comes into office, Republican or Democrat, they're still going to be riding that wave of change. The other wave of change was President Trump proving that you can, in fact, impose tariffs and challenge China without markets crashing in the United States and without GDP and employment figures taking a hit. There were lots of dire predictions at the beginning of the Trump administration by very distinguished columnists and economists that said that the United States was heading into a recession and that this Trump trade war was going to crash the economy. Both were profoundly wrong. No one should listen to these people ever again. But aside from that, the Democratic Party, as it's picking its leadership this cycle and the next, are likely going to be picking from among candidates that are going to end up supporting some elements of this rebalancing or challenging the U.S.-China trade relationship. Mm-hmm. As the Hong Kong demonstrations have made clear, they're likely to increase the number of candidates that are going to side with freedom movements and question the integrity of the Communist Party of China, the validity of any deals with the Chinese Communist Party of China. The Washington Post running regular commentary about the Uyghur persecution is slowly but steadily changing perceptions. And so most Americans don't know what a Uyghur is. But they now know that there are large numbers of Muslims that are being persecuted by the Communist Party of China in a systematic way. And that changes the way they think about China as a country, but the CCP as a regime. And so these fundamentals, I think, have been changed in the Trump era in significant ways that will echo in whomever follows him, Republican or Democrat. And that, by its nature, will affect how Americans think about Taiwan. It may not be stable, but I still think it's an environment that is net advantageous to the Taiwan people.
So you're basically saying because the U.S. policy toward China is going to stay stable for a while, so the U.S. policy toward Taiwan is going to stay the same.
Right. It's just going to be stable in an era of competition and adjustment with China. So the status quo in U.S.-China policy of the last several presidencies has been upset. And I think that upset is going to continue for at least one, maybe more, presidencies. And the only thing that will change that is if there's political change in China. And then all of U.S.-China relations get reconsidered and reset.
Interesting. All right. Do you have anything else to add?
No, I just hope everyone has a wonderful and glorious new year in 2020. And we certainly will have no shortage of things to talk about with elections in Taiwan, legislative council elections in Hong Kong, and the American election in November.
That's true. Thank you very much, Stephen.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay.